Welcome everybody back to Understanding Climate Finance. My name is Fahim Nurali. I'm the Climate Finance Trade Commissioner based out of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. We've had some really great guests so far in 2022, and we're adding to that repertoire tonight. So it's my pleasure to introduce Greg Watson, Principal Specialist leading the IDB's Biodiversity Cluster and its Natural Capital Lab. As Greg will explain, the lab serves as a one-stop shop for the IDB group and partners to drive innovation in natural capital finance. It works to incubate, accelerate, and scale new solutions to pressing environmental problems by looking at nature as an asset. Greg also leads IDB's efforts into mainstream biodiversity across the bank and in countries. Previously, Greg was a lead specialist at IDB Labs Climate Smart Agriculture team, where he led IDB's first equity investment in oceans, led an award-winning forest investment program, Equity Investment, in a Silvo Pastoral System in Brazil, worked to develop a new asset class for natural capital trading, and design other private sector projects in forestry, development impact bonds, and technology in the natural capital space. I can go on about the significant work that Greg has led. For example, some of you may be familiar with ClimateScope, the first ever ranking of the investment climate for climate investment in Latin America and the Caribbean region, or the Eco Micro Green Microfinance Program, which was selected by the UNFCCC as a Global Lighthouse Award. He launched those and raised over $50 million from the GCF, CIFS, and other bilateral donors in this position. Greg has a master's degree in international development from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and a bachelor from Tufts University. So thank you so much, Greg, for being a part of this podcast.
Thrilled to be here today. Thanks so much for having me.
No, it's really my pleasure. I mean, we really see from your accomplishments at IDB alone, how significant you've been in this space and how important this space is becoming. And so I thought I would kick off our conversation by asking you, what is the Natural Capital Lab and how does it fit with the broader IDB Vision 2025 and IDB's climate and sustainability strategy?
Sure, thanks. And I guess it's useful to start by thinking about where we are globally, even looking at climate change as an issue, jeopardizing water, food sources in our region that are nourishing not only our region, but the world. Endangering the CO2 sponges that are our rainforests, threatening to unleash climate-induced migration crises and other natural disasters. And with the world collectively falling short of critical goals, the MDBs have an important role to play, ramping up ambition, developing concrete plans, and demonstrating leadership on the climate issue. And, you know, in the Latin America and Caribbean region, many IDB countries are not major contributors to climate change, but they are some of the biggest proponents of actions to address it. And in our region, we have countries that are among the world's most biodiverse and also at the most risk to climate impact. Latin America has 40% of the globe's biodiversity. And so this biodiversity is really one of the key factors that our countries have, not only to move their economies, but also to confront these challenges of climate change. And investing in the region's future means that we need to invest in nature. And that's why at the IDB, we're taking these action-oriented steps on climate and nature as part of our central strategy called Vision 2025. And, you know, as we're hopefully now starting to come out of the COVID crisis and into the post-pandemic period, we see that the recovery represents a huge opportunity to reinvest in this natural capital for green growth and to create jobs and a more sustainable, resilient. Half of global GDP is moderately or highly dependent on nature. This was according to a recent World Economic Forum report. And it's a fact that by protecting irreplaceable ecosystem services, we create a lot of jobs. We generate income at many times for some of the most vulnerable members of our society. And we can really mobilize the private sector investment that's really essential. And so that's why at the IDB, nature is taking an increasingly important place in our programming. We were really happy to lead work amongst the MDBs at COP26 to create the joint statement on nature, people, and planet, which 10 MDBs in the end signed up to and outlined our commitment to support nature positive finance, to mainstream biodiversity across our own operations and to support our countries in mainstreaming biodiversity, but also to integrate nature into the financial system. And so where does that lead, you know, the Natural Capital Lab and the programs that I work on? So we're the program that's really working to drive that inside the bank. We work across all parts of the bank and work with IDB Invest to provide technical support, but also to provide from certain funding sources that we have, grant support or blended finance support to operations. We also work on the structural documents and the strategies for mainstreaming these topics, really making visible the value of nature and the contribution of nature to our different sectors and to our countries. And then also piloting and providing some, I call it runway, to innovative projects that really could have a demonstration effect going forward. And we were created in 2018 with funding from France and the United Kingdom. We're really happy to see other MDBs now starting to adopt this model. And just in, you know, in the last year, just a few high points, we started integrating biodiversity and natural capital into the earliest stages of our country strategy processes. So that's making sure that when we're looking at transport investments or infrastructure investments or even, you know, education and labor market investments, we're looking at the role that nature can play and the nature investment can play there. And we've also started working directly with countries. So we supported Costa Rica in developing their blue economy COVID-19 recovery strategy, and also developing 15 financial investment plans for projects that generate biodiversity, income, and resilience benefits. And then, you know, we also work with countries. We're working directly with Colombia to integrate biodiversity into their national planning, their national economic strategies, looking at ways to value nature within the kind of GDP context so that the cost benefit of these interventions is very clear from an economic standpoint. And this year, we'll be publishing our action plan on mainstreaming natural capital across the institution, which should be approved, we hope, in the next quarter. And this is all as the IDB has made a commitment to from 30 to 35% of climate finance, subject to our governor's approval, hopefully soon, but also developing an institutional goal for green finance that includes nature positive finance. So that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg, but there's a lot that's going on. And we're the team that's really trying to work across the bank to drive this forward.
That's great. And it's really interesting. I mean, in summary, it looks like you're really working behind the scenes to make sure that nature-based solutions is integrated throughout the whole bank group. So both on the sovereign side and even with your investment officers. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that requires a lot of convincing, right? It's looking at nature in a different way, because I think traditionally most economic actors, most investors have seen nature either as a risk or as a cost to be protected. And what we're really trying to do is change the paradigm and to show that by incorporating nature, by integrating nature-based solutions, by doing interventions around conservation and restoration of ecosystems, actually, you're going to have, in the long run, lower cost, longer lived projects that have increased benefits across many different sectors. And, you know, we could go into depth about in different sectors about what those are, but it's going from kind of a narrow focus of what traditionally you would look at in an accounting framework of dollars and cents to look at the additional benefits, job creation, et cetera, but then also to try to put into dollars and cents language some of these benefits that in the past, maybe we didn't account that way, so that you could see, for example, that if you do reforestation activities upstream of a large hydro, that you're going to reduce sedimentation and that hydro will have, you know, a longer life and actually will have lower cost of maintenance over the long term. So the small upfront cost of that reforestation is actually going to drive huge benefits to the projects over the long term. And that's kind of a pretty obvious example, but there's a lot of ways that we could go more in depth and look at that. And then on the other side, besides making these arguments, what we're trying to do is to actually work with our teams and develop new financial instruments and mechanisms. And so those can be bonds, those can be capital market solutions, those can be investment vehicles. And it's usually a combination of being inventive with the structures and the financial tools that we have, being inventive with the way that we're looking and classifying those values, like I just mentioned before. And then finally, making sure that providing the tools and the verification and the measurement of the impact so that operators can actually see the results on the ground and make those visible not only to their shareholders, but also to local populations and to governments. And so that's a bit of what we also try to do on the finance side. And we do that with some of the blended finance that we have, and also with some of the kind of early pilot support that we directly do, but also that we do with our partners across the bank, which is actually much larger volumes of finance.
That's great. And actually, that leads me to my next question. You know, you mentioned blended finance and some of these other financial innovations. Can you share some specific examples of where that's been applied?
Yeah, sure. And I guess I'll start with a geographic approach, just because last year, the bank actually launched its Amazon initiative. And within part of that, there's a bioeconomy initiative and biodiversity initiative. And the Amazon, as probably everybody listening here knows, is a critically important ecosystem. It's providing, you know, besides global climate change benefits, it's providing 40% of Latin America's fresh water. It's regulating air quality. It's regulating nutrient and hydrological cycles for the South American continent. And so this is a really important ecosystem that we need to change the paradigm around the way that economies are working, the way that jobs are happening, the way that income is being generated there. And so that's what this Amazon initiative is looking at, supporting regenerative activities across the Amazon basin, across four pillars: bioeconomy, land use, forestry, and human capital and cities. But as part of that, you know, our team was involved in working with the bank to develop a $279 million Amazon Bioeconomy Fund from the Green Climate Fund, which should actually sum up to about $600 million total when you add in all of the kind of co-financing that will come around that. And that will support this vital biome. And at the same time, you know, there's some funds from the IDB that can support project development. And this is all to support projects that the bank will do around these four areas. In the first quarter of 2022, we're developing four projects with blended finance from funds that the Natural Capital Lab has been managing from the government of France. And these will support, for example, biotrade by indigenous communities in the Bolivian Amazon. They will scale habitat banking and private sector-led compensation banking models in Colombia, where you know, you do restorative activities on one plot of land that can compensate for damages in another plot of land under a national framework. And there's a private market to basically trade those. We also are supporting the restoration and conservation of forests in Honduras, you know, outside of the Amazon, and also working with biodiversity institutes to actually create a pipeline of businesses that can be investable. But if we want to go into kind of more specific financial vehicles that we've been working with in the last year, we approved some projects that I think are really transformative because we're trying to look at the entire finance cycle. I mentioned that we're starting to work with biodiversity institutes to develop new products at the early stage. But if you look at the life cycle of developing a market, you have, you know, let's do some R&D at the very early indigenous business stage. Then you have a lot of NGO-funded activities that help small businesses basically get on their feet. Usually that gets them to a certain level where they're not quite market ready. And then what we saw in the past was that there were a lot of accelerators that maybe had concessional that were out there, but they weren't really able to interface with those businesses. And so there was a gap. What we're trying to do now, and what we did last year, was we approved with IDB Lab a Regenerate Accelerator, which is a fund that will support in the Amazon risk capital for those businesses. So it will take them from that, you know, kind of early proof of concept and early market stage and get them to the stage where they're ready to receive an investment of about $1 million or so. And it'll help them through, you know, concessional finance, such as contingent recovery grants, simple agreements for future equity, and this more flexible type of financing than just concessional debt. At the same time, our team worked with the capital markets division of the bank, so the public sector side of the bank, to develop in Peru, for example, a $20 million loan through national development banks for bioeconomy lending, wherein that's also associated with some grant money that we provided to do blended finance that will allow these national development banks to provide funding through national financial institutions, and banks, and through local, you know, smaller credit cooperatives to bioeconomy businesses that maybe can fill that, you know, $1 million, $700,000 investment need once these businesses can graduate from that kind of regenerate accelerator that I mentioned. And then at the same time, you know, we have active conversations with the large investors that are out there in the world, you know, Midov, and there's several, you know, there's that have been launched in the past year. HSBC announced a fund. There's a number of investors that are interested in this space that could then be ready to pick up these businesses on the other side. And so it's really important to us to be working across the full scale there of financial instruments. At the same time, it's important for us to be creating digital platforms that allow this matchmaking to happen. And so we've been developing with our Amazon Initiative colleagues, where you can have geospatial platforms that show where projects are happening. You can sort them by what their impacts are on the ground, whether or not they're indigenous-led, women-led. Is this an agroforestry? Is it a tourism business? What kind of finance are they looking for, so that investors can sort very quickly to develop a pipeline? And hopefully that should be coming online later this year. And then, you know, outside of the Amazon, if you'll let me just take another minute or two, we've done some interesting work in Chile. We supported the creation of the first conservation trust fund. We're also developing a business plan for national laboratories, which is basically science centers where you can be creating actual whole economies around remote sensing, AI technologies that can be commercialized around ecotourism, scientific tourism, but it requires identifying what those investment needs are, what the returns are on those investments, and being able to market them in the right way. And actually, we've just also started working on interesting financing models for debt nature conversions as well with certain countries where in the bond markets as well. And on the private bond side, we're starting to develop species bonds. And we actually have been developing one with several different actors across several different countries. And we're hoping that this is the year that we can move forward with partners in IDB Invest to make that a reality.
Interesting. I'm curious, how does a species bond work? I've never really heard of that.
So some of your listeners might have heard of the Rhino Bond that was being piloted in Africa, which is kind of a results-based payment model. We've been looking at two different models. One is a public, well, I'll talk more about the private-led model, where you actually, the species is basically a charismatic cover for activities that a bond would invest in that are landscape management activities. And a lot of these could take place either on farms and working lands where you need to have, you know, sustainable management of that land, or you could do agroforestry systems or silvopastoral systems or other kinds of, you know, different kinds of pasturing that could actually improve the biodiversity of the area. Or you could also include what I was mentioning, habitat banking before and compensation banking. You could include those kinds of models as well. But the idea is to put together enough of those kinds of interventions in critically important habitat areas for a specific species that you're having an aggregate impact on the habitat. And so that then you could commercialize a bond around that could invest in those activities. And so I don't want to go too far into the details because it's something that we're still developing with the specific client, but broadly it's that. And then the important part is that you have a charismatic species where this habitat is critically important and you're able to link to verifiable indicators around either, you know, population of the species within that habitat or the expanse of the habitat and things like that. So that's a bit of that. And I should have mentioned earlier, I didn't, but the other really interesting financial model and instrument that we've been working on that escaped my mind is actually one that we worked on with the Intrinsic Exchange Group, which is developing almost like an IPO of the value of nature, where they're called natural asset companies, where you can value public or private land, take that value, and the underlying land remains under the ownership of the state or under the private actor that owns it. But the actual, if you think of it almost like air rights above a building, the stream of ecosystem services and intrinsic value of that ecosystem is then valued, transferred to a natural asset company, and you can then do an accounting of that, you know, following kind of traditional corporate accounting methods. and do an IPO of the value of that company based on that value stream. And that allows you then to move something that historically has been both unpriced and unmonetized into a regulated market where it could be both priced and monetized. And obviously the shares, when you do this, certain shares of this, there's benefit distribution to the owner of the underlying land and the underlying natural asset to, you know, any indigenous populations or communities that are involved in managing that land. But it's a way that we could hopefully start to see really interesting ways of monetizing this kind of intrinsic value. And that's something that we worked on for many, many years with IDB Lab. And actually the project signed a MOU with the New York Stock Exchange last October. There were some announcements around this. And we've also worked with several countries to begin to process to move their natural assets to developing these kinds of natural asset companies for the exchange in the future. So that's also something that we think is really interesting. And some private corporates also are looking at developing these natural asset companies in order to monetize the value of their, I'd say, nature positive activities.
That's really interesting and really exciting to see these different innovative mechanisms that you're applying to nature. And I'll just take a quick second to plug IDB Lab, we did a podcast with them earlier. So I encourage our listeners to listen to my interview with Anita Fiore, where she actually does the regenerative fund. And then our first podcasts were with the IDB's blended finance team. So if you're interested in learning how blended finance works, definitely listen to the interview we had with Pilar and Mateo. We're hearing a lot more about nature-based solutions appropriately post-COP. Why do you think there's a sudden interest in nature-based solutions? And when you're looking at some of the outcomes of COP, particularly I'm thinking around, you know, the carbon accounting outcomes, how does that benefit nature-based solutions?
Sure. So I actually think, you know, this COP was one of the first to have nature as one of the three main pillars. And there were many countries that, you know, the UK was very strong about this and many like-minded countries, Canada being one of them, where, you know, we're very supportive of including nature in the climate agenda. And I think it makes a lot of sense. And we're kind of seeing the reconvergence of the nature and climate themes to some extent, because nature-based solutions are key in mitigation and adaptation to climate change, but they're also having these other co-benefits on public health, on job creation, on clean water. You know, nature-based solutions offer the potential to provide over a third of climate mitigation by 2030. You know, in our region where we see key industries like tourism, agriculture, forestry, fishing, all kind of endangered by climate, these are ripe areas for nature-based solutions to come in, because nature-based solutions have always existed. I mean, in some cases, we've called them traditional knowledge, or we've called them, you know, in other cases, we've called them local knowledge. But, you know, nature has been providing a number of these services since well before we have been here. And we've kind of engineered nature out of the equation. And now we're trying to engineer it back into these equations. These strategic investments can really buttress national goals across these multiple areas. And so I think the countries are starting to say, look, I can meet my carbon objective, and at the same time, I could meet resilience objectives by looking at mangroves as a nature-based solution. That makes a lot of sense for my coastal protection of this city if I've got mangroves, you know, outside of my city and they're degraded. So, you know, to your question about, you know, focus on carbon, and that's one example that I would give. And if you look at just infrastructure needs, I mean, Latin America and the Caribbean's infrastructure needs are estimated to be between $179 billion and $313 billion per year. And that's a huge opportunity for nature-based solutions, because you can replace or complement gray infrastructure like dams and pipes and seawalls and roads and treatment plants with these green solutions, and even have green-gray infrastructure, which is more cost-effective and sustainable than the traditional ones. And so really, I think it's this combination of a lot of different actors saying, look, I can have multiple benefits from one project. I think we all need to help make visible what those benefits are, and again, help to account for them and to lead the way in showing how these multiple national objectives or multiple business objectives can be met with these solutions. And then I think, you know, we've had a challenge with nature-based solutions because they've been hard to make bankable and hard to make scalable. I think investors have been looking for large-scale investment-ready projects, and that requires performance data on how and when nature is going to deliver results. And it requires business cases that show that there are financial returns. It requires us to lower the transaction costs to make replication easier. But I think that we're starting to move towards that with different toolkits and guides and examples that we've published in the past several years. And if you go to our publications website and type in nature-based solutions, you'll find a plethora of materials, including some toolkits that we developed specifically with engineering firms for integrating nature-based solutions. And we have to crowd in private sector in order to do this. There's increasing private sector funds that are earmarked for environmental and climate-related investments. And you know, there's been a coalition of institutional asset managers that's aiming to raise $10 billion for nature and nature-based solutions. 25 of the world's largest banks have set asides for sustainable finance commitments. And so if we can get the policy and the regulatory framework right, and we can get the key performance indicators right, and we can get these kind of enabling toolkits and I'd say indicators right, we have a huge opportunity to channel even just a tiny portion of this into these infrastructure needs. We would have a huge benefit for both climate and for nature.
Thanks, Greg. That's been really helpful explanation. And particularly, I see your point that nature-based solutions have been hard to bank and scale in the past, and having data come in and innovation come in to attract the private sector has been really critical. So I was wondering if you could share some of the strategies for nature-based finance that you see and that you've used.
Sure. Last year, we published with World Resources Institute four documents, one of which is actually specifically about this topic of financial strategies for nature-based solutions. And if you actually look back at the bank's portfolio, we've done about $815 million of NBS projects since 2015. So, we're learning from all of these examples. And what we found is that there's kind of four categories of strategies for nature-based finance that are emerging. One of them is debt. So green bonds, I think many of your listeners probably are familiar, are emerging as a fast-growing sector in the market. It's a familiar vehicle for allocating capital towards sustainability. They differ from traditional bonds in that they require that proceeds support environmental or low-carbon investments, but they're becoming very popular for green capital allocations. We've actually seen two examples that are actually in these publications as case studies that demonstrate using green bonds to finance nature-based solutions. The Dutch government issued a $6.6 billion sovereign green bond, which was actually focused on cost-effective ways to finance green-gray infrastructure, such as nature reserves and upgraded dikes to protect against flooding. And then here in the U.S., the Central Arkansas Water issued a $31 million green bond to finance green-gray infrastructure, where the proceeds of the bond were actually allocated to forest acquisition costs to protect the forested watersheds for water quality, but also to increase efficiency of water delivery through pipeline upgrades. And so those are two examples where, a kind of a traditional debt bond model incorporated nature-based solutions. We also talked earlier a little bit about blended finance and how blended finance can catalyze market rate investment. By blending different kinds of grants or concessional resources with investment resources, it allows us to basically smooth out where the benefits of nature-based solutions can be substantial but accrue to multiple stakeholders and communities at different stages of the project, or where you need different backings from multiple stakeholders to recruit the support. And so this allows us to kind of mitigate a lot of those risks. And we've seen some interesting examples here. In California, there was a mix of concessional and market rate loans for disaster risk mitigation that paid $4 million for upfront costs to improve forest health on public lands, to reduce the risk of wildfires, and to improve delivery of water and energy services for a utility. And we can get, there's lots of different ways that we could look at ways to blend finance to support these kinds of approaches. I'd say the third strategy is around the policy frameworks, like I mentioned earlier. There have been some really interesting city-led land-based financing instruments, such as building rights transfers and developer fees, which can generate revenues to finance green gray infrastructure. And they raise the revenue by charging fees for the right to build or by billing developers for extra costs associated with delivering public services. And we've seen this in places where there's growing demand for development, transparent and inclusive governance, and strong urban planning. So Mexico City is using this to generate revenue for both affordable housing and transportation, but also green gray infrastructure, such as improved water catchment. We've also seen that this is something popular in other cities in Brazil, Argentina, and Colombia, especially as disaster risk and climate change is being incorporated into planning and policies. We're seeing that, again, this link to the COP, as you mentioned, nature-based solutions and green gray infrastructure is really starting to kind of be more common in those plans. And for example, Santa Fe, Argentina is using these land-based financing mechanisms like betterment levies to co-finance green gray infrastructure. It performed a feasibility assessment to evaluate effectiveness of tree cover, new vegetated areas, runoff reduction, and floodable public spaces. And, you know, basically then is going to integrate that into its planning and to its funding streams going forward, into its tenders going forward. So cities all around are doing this. And we have a toolkit actually developed for cities for integrating biodiversity, which is also on our website and our public set. And we actually are actively training cities in the use of this toolkit so that they can be better and ready to engage with the private sector when they're tendering these kinds of activities. And then last, I'd say risk mitigation. The insurance industry can provide a lot of interesting models for the potential benefits of nature-based solutions. The standardized simulations and models generate upfront estimates of the risk reduction, which you can then translate into return and revenue. We've been working actually with a project in the Mesoamerican reef area where actually you insure coral reefs as natural infrastructure because that reef is providing myriad benefits of coastal protection to landowners, to, you know, infrastructure, vital, critical coastal infrastructure, both housing, but also, you know, water treatment plants, businesses. It's providing habitat for the fish that the fishermen and the fishing businesses utilize. It's providing a lot of the benefit to the tourism industry that, you know, depends on the value of that reef being there. And so when you can start to actually look at this, calculate the potential risks of that reef disappearing or of damage to that reef, you can actually insure it as an asset. And then also, if there's damages from a natural disaster, you could use kind of the payments to repair it more quickly. And you could hopefully also have some resources in these models for ongoing reef maintenance and reef improvement activities as well. So we were involved in actually valuing the Mesoamerican reef and all of those services and working with various different insurance companies on pilots to set up these insurance models for the reef. And so that's basically some of the different strategies that we've seen. I think that, you know, I mentioned before, we did about $815 million in green and green gray projects between 2015 and 2020. And they leveraged about another $436 million. So that's about $1.25 billion in nature-based solutions projects in 5 years. And we're going to continue to do this. You know, we are actively now looking at how we can integrate the concept of nature-based solutions early into our country dialogue process, but also support countries to begin to think about this so that when beginning to do their planning and their tendering processes, nature-based solutions are on their minds and that they're better able to explain what they're looking for and look at the benefits that are going to be coming from these kinds of projects. Because it requires looking beyond just the infrastructure improvement or just beyond the environmental improvement and also looking at those, you know, socioeconomic impacts as well, which are generally quite positive. So that's on our kind of to-do list going forward. And we are eager to continue that work.
No, I think that's great. And that certainly helps, you know, with a lot of our audience who will eventually bid on some of these tenders. And so the better defined these tenders are and in integrating nature-based solutions certainly helps everybody. So what would you like our Canadian audience, whether project or even funds interested in the space, how would you like for them to prepare for a conversation with you? And what should they know going into the conversation?
So my role is that of a facilitator. I work transversely across the whole group to encourage the better integration of natural capital, to provide technical advice, and to make connections, and sometimes to provide a little bit of concessional finance from the funds that we are helping to manage. My program doesn't fund projects directly. I work with the various sectors of the bank. So the, you know, my colleagues in the transport sector or in the cities sector or in IDB Lab or in IDB Invest. And so the most important thing for me is to always have a value proposition to present, to think through how a project is supporting multiple goals, because I need to be able to explain that to my colleagues who maybe are not so convinced that this is something that they want to or need to do in their project. So, you know, for example, it's really useful to be able to explain, you know, how does a proposed project leverage a dollar spent to help achieve the climate, biodiversity, employment, infrastructure, you know, inclusion, health, or other aims? Not one project is going to hit all of those, but the most successful ones and the easiest ones for me to sell are going to be the ones that can show those multiple benefits. And that's going to help me to help a partner build a larger group of supporters for that project and potentially tap larger sources of funds. Second, it's vitally important to think about how the project is linked to country priorities and challenges. Because again, mapping a project's aims to national strategies, be them the development plans, the infrastructure plans, the agriculture plans, the climate goals of the NDC, or the biodiversity goals in the Biodiversity Strategy and Action Plan, is really important. And the more national goals that a project meets, the better. And, you know, because I'm working with both the public sector parts of the bank and the private sector. And obviously, the public sector bank works with the countries as the clients who then develop projects that then move forward and seek implementing partners on the ground. So those public clients are going to be really interested in how the eventual partners on the ground are aligned with those national strategies. And with the private sector partners within the bank, where maybe there's a more direct access route to financing, there's still a lot of interest in our, you know, Vision 2025 strategy of aligning with the Paris Agreement, and, you know, which is a commitment that was made at the COP by the bank and with other climate strategies. So it's important to show those. And then this third, and this one should be obvious, is that we need to see what the overall impact is on natural capital. So what's the impact on conservation of restoration of area of land or sea habitat? You know, what are the critical ecosystem services that are going to be improved? Is there a link to the sustainable bioeconomy? You know, what are the natural resources and the natural capital assets that are going to be protected, improved by the project? And you know, it sometimes people are not totally clear about exactly the intervention path of the project and how it's going to deliver those. And for me to be supportive and to help bridge to my colleagues, I really need to be able to see that clearly so that I move forward. And then I'd say last, just be clear about your needs. Like, what kind of financing are you seeking? What stage of development is the project in? Because that helps me determine how to best connect you to the right sector or to the right part of the bank. I mean, if you're only looking for equity, there's a couple of folks in the bank that you know, we can talk to. There's not a huge range. If you're looking, if you have a more general concept of a solution that you are interested in applying, then, you know, we can talk about that and see whether or not there are existing projects in execution or in the pipeline that already are looking at that problem, or if that's something that we are currently in dialogue with some clients about trying to solve, or is that something that's ripe for our IDB Invest or IDB Lab colleagues to directly start to support? So, you know, being a bit clear on at least which of those routes you're interested in taking, I think is important. So I think I would stop there with at least the list of my demands, but also that I'm very eager to engage with external partners, because that's how we learn. And that's how I, you know what's going on out there in the market, and I'm able to make a link. Maybe it's not even today, right? We may have a conversation in March of 2022, and there's not something currently in the pipeline, but 6 months from now, there is interest of a client or of a project in something. And if we've had a conversation and I know that there's a solution out there in the market, I'm ready to say, ah, well, actually, I've seen this, and this is what I saw, and this might be an interesting partner to engage with. And so I always like to be able to be ready with a Rolodex of great ideas.
You know, the other thing that you mentioned, which I think is probably a whole other podcast, is on impact measurement and impact management, in how that story, that impact story, can be integrated into the larger conversation. I'm thinking more on the investment side, but certainly on even the sovereign side as well.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's vital, especially in this space where you can have greenwashing, but also in a space where results-based payments are becoming more and more in fashion, you know, being able to identify the results, verify the results, and report on the results is just extremely important. And especially as, you know, I was talking earlier about the links to national strategies and plans, and we were talking about the links to COP. You know, there's the climate COP, but there's also the biodiversity COP. And I think, and people shouldn't forget about that, COP15, which is taking place in China later this year, is going to set new targets for every country for the post-2020 global biodiversity framework. And so countries will also have global biodiversity targets that they're trying to meet. And so if these projects are being sold as contributing to this, and that's how they're attracting concessional resources or attracting investors or attracting the interest of the government, we have to be able to be sure that we're tracking those indicators that are linked to those plans and to those commitments. And I think, you know, it's just a vital piece of the pie that I think too often is forgotten. So thank you for mentioning it.
No, and it is critically important. So thanks, Greg. This has been awesome. This has been great. I really appreciate the conversation and the fact that you're here on the podcast describing nature-based solutions, not only within the context of IDB, but how important it is globally. And I really appreciated the fact that you said that you're sort of changing the paradigm. And the way that I sort of took that is that looking at or investing in nature-based solutions isn't so much of a cost, but it's more of a long-term investment. And we're, like you said, engineering nature back into our solutions when we sort of engineered it out for so long. So thank you so much, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah. So, and thank you to everyone that's been listening to the podcast. I hope you got everything out of this that I did. Please let me know if you're interested in connecting with Greg and his team, and I'm happy to talk to you and make the connection as appropriate. With that, please also feel free to provide me comments on this podcast through Spotify, through Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and rate us. This has been a production of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C., and I look forward to our next episode soon. Thank you.